Mr. Blumenthal, first of all, I want to ask you, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I've been covering the movement that I think has controlled the Republican grassroots since George W. Bush was elected and had an enormous influence on the Republican Party. During the last 20 years, the Christian right, and I've been covering this movement for 6 years, and as I covered it, I discovered, first of all, that the mainstream media was derelict. They were not providing thorough coverage of this movement's intentions, its machinations, or who was behind it. And beyond that, I found just in talking to the members of the movement and its leaders that there was a psychology, a political psychology that ran throughout the movement that was consistent, that held it together, and that helped explain a lot of the extreme policies and political maneuvering of the Republican Party. And so I decided to put this book together and embark on this project to explain what that psychology was, to explain just more than who the people in the movement were, or what they did, why they were the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
Max, this is Teresa Caraggio. I have a radio show called Third Paradigm. And first, I just want to thank you for this book. It is such a romp of a read. And I've heard you a couple interviews so far, and it's fascinating. There couldn't be a greater parody of what's going on than the truth is.
But, the truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you a little bit more about, or I guess talk a little bit more about the title. Because on my show, one of the things I go into is biblical history. I do a people's history of the Bible. And what my research is showing is that we're really not doing anyone a favor by pretending that the Bible is a book of sweetness and light. It's really vicious. I would actually describe it as a hate document. It was written in the 70s, right when the Rome was brutally suppressing the successful insurgency of the Judeans. And my belief is, with a lot of evidence to back it, that it was written as a way of proposing a myth that would counter the religion that had fueled that insurgency, and that everything in it is an analogy. So if you take the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, you have the same God who doesn't, you know, it says that all of the men in the city came out and were about to, wanted Lot to send out the stranger in his house. And instead, he wants to send out his two virgin daughters. So the same God who condemns the homosexuality, supposedly, if you can believe that, you know, any town has every man in it that could show up to try to rape some stranger, the same God approves of the gang rape of two virgin daughters who are later impregnated by their father in another move that is approved by Lot, or by God, and that the prototype for that story is even worse. It's the late Levite's concubine, in which the concubine runs away and gets sent back by the Levite, and he sends her out where she is abused until dawn and finally dies on the lintel of the steppe, where he cuts her into seven pieces and sends them to the tribes of Israel. So I guess that's just my comment, is that when we look at Gomorrah, I think that we should take it with a grain of salt, which actually was the Gnostic symbol for wisdom. And when you think about Lot's wife looking back and turning into a pillar of salt, maybe that is a pillar of wisdom, and that Sodom and Gomorrah were actually not the places that they've been portrayed in the Bible.
Well, the Bible is obviously allegorical. This movement, which is led largely by fundamentalists, views it literally. And they view it literally because for their own reasons, because the Bible, they've exploited the Bible, mm-hmm. used it to wield over people who have fallen into what they consider to be a sinful lifestyle and need to follow what God wants for them instead of what they want for themselves, because they believe when they do what they want to do, they will inevitably slide into sin, they will slouch towards Gomorrah. Although I don't regard half of what they do as sinful, they do because they've adapted the culture of lower middle class Protestant lifestyle from Europe, from 18th century Europe, to this country. This movement largely reflects immigrant patterns from Northern Europe of the lower middle class. But beyond that, the reason I called it this book Gomorrah was because in popular culture, Gomorrah is regarded as a city of sin, but the Republican Party is supposed to be the Family Values Party, the party that, you know, is all about God, guns, and gays. But in my book, and my book reads very much like the biblical tale of Sodom and Gomorrah, this movement collapses in all these bizarre homosexual escapades, heterosexual escapades, criminality, even murder, mass murder.
Yeah, all those scandals.
From Ted Haggard and his male escort to Matthew Murray, who was homeschooled and kept away from secular society by followers of James Dobson and eventually went insane and went on a shooting spree in Ted Haggard's church, to Tom DeLay, the most corrupt House Majority Leader in history, who was converted by James Dobson, to Ted Bundy, the worst serial killer in history, who was converted by James Dobson. These people reflect the sensibility of this movement, and it is in so many ways a sadomasochistic sensibility, the same sensibility that's reflected by this angry God in the Bible. There's also a loving God in the Bible. There are many gods in the Bible, but they are particularly attracted to the sadomasochistic vision of the angry God and of the macho Jesus. What the pastor, Mark Driscoll, a very popular evangelical pastor from Seattle, especially among the 30-something set, calls ultimate fighting Jesus, who has big biceps and calloused hands. It's the Jesus in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, which is 2 hours of unexpurgated sadomasochism and pornographic violence. Probably the most violent movie I've seen since Red Dawn, another conservative favorite. And Mel Gibson is the only successful propagandist of this movement, the only one who's been able to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And he's made it through these movies, which end with this vision of self-destruction, where the hero, the protagonist, whether it's Jesus or William Wallace, and this movement is also very preoccupied with William Wallace, the Scottish separatist, is torn to pieces at the end of the movie and screams freedom because he's being freed from his own body, this shameful scepter which led him into sin in the first place. That's what the men of this movement particularly want, is freedom from their own bodies. Mm-hmm. So you're on to something through that reading of Gomorrah. And it does go beyond the way Gomorrah is reflected in our popular culture and the resonances of that into the attraction of this movement to an angry God and pornographic violence against evildoers.
And Max, it seems like if the Christian fundamentalist right is taking the Bible literally, we should then be calling them on whether God approves of the gang rape of teenage virgins and of fathers impregnating their daughters. Because that's literally in the Bible, too. So
we should be calling them on their real-life support for rape. We should be calling them on the vote of 30 Republican senators who are connected to the Christian right to block federal courts from hearing a lawsuit by a woman who was gang raped in Iraq by Halliburton contractors.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
We should be calling them on their attempts to prevent women from getting the morning after pill the day after they're raped. We should be calling them on their attempts to prevent women from getting HPV vaccines to prevent them from getting cervical cancer. We should be calling them on all of that because in real life, they support policies that do not that make women vulnerable to rape.
And you expose this so beautifully in the book. And could you say a little bit about the child-rearing practices that create this personality, the sadomasochist, and why, what the sado is, what the masochist is? And you wrote also about the fact that these people cannot contain their any kind of tension between what they're feeling And so they have to adhere to a rigid doctrine that comes out in following a strict religion or listening to a certain leader. They can't think for themselves. They don't have an ability to be reflective and to really analyze.
Well, let me
and where that comes
talk
from.
About corporal punishment and how it leads to sadomasochism. The most influential member of this movement, the central figure in my book, is James Dobson. It's not only because he is directly responsible for the re-election of George W. Bush and the rise of the Republican Congress in 2004, but because he cultivated the sensibility of the movement, the psychology that binds the followers and leaders together. He's not a religious figure, even though he leads a religious movement. He has no theological credentials, even though he's the most widely recognized and popular figure in the Christian right. He is a child psychologist who wrote a book called Dare to Discipline in 1970. It's a manual for corporal punishment and what I would consider to be child abuse. And he didn't write it for its own sake. He wrote it because he believed this form of child rearing would turn back the counterculture by raising up a new generation of belt-wielding Republican radicals. He held Benjamin Spock, the other child-rearing guru, as responsible for the counterculture because so many of the children of the baby boom generation were raised on his techniques, like picking up your child when the child cries. So Dobson prescribed, for example, pinching muscles in a child's neck. He said pain is a marvelous purifier. He said children should be hit with neutral objects when they're disobedient because hands are for loving. And he said a child should be spanked with sufficient magnitude as to make him cry. But when the child's finished crying, he will want to crumple to your breast. You should welcome the child with warm and loving arms. So what Dobson has prescribed right there is hitting and loving. Hitting and loving at the same time.
And how does that set? How does that set the person up for that kind of behavior as an adult?
And so that's sadomasochism. And Philip Graven, who wrote a book about the connections between, he wrote a book called "Spare the Child: The Religious Roots of Punishment and the Psychological Impact of Physical Abuse." Has written that whenever children suffer from painful physical punishments and humiliating submission to more powerful authorities, sadomasochism will be present. Sadomasochism is thus one of the most enduring consequences of coercive discipline in childhood. But what Graven is referring to is the sadomasochism identified by the psychologist Eric Fromm in his book Escape from Freedom, which is an analysis of the authoritarian character. It's more than a sexual kink, Fromm points out. Sadomasochism is actually the essential component of the authoritarian personality. They're sadistic in that they yearn to kick down and hurt social deviants and those they perceive as weaker than them, like homosexuals, minorities, Jews, foreigners, the poor, all of the targets of the Republican Revolution. At the same time, they're masochistic in that they have this urge to bow down and submit themselves before strong leaders, from George W. Bush to James Dobson to the macho Jesus from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. So that's the connection.
Right, you speak about that bowing down with reference to President Eisenhower, who not only cautioned us to beware the military-industrial complex, but also those who seek freedom from the necessity of informing themselves and making up their own minds concerning tremendous, complex, and difficult questions. So another kowtowing to authority, which is set up also by that early childhood corporal punishment collapse of the ego deal that you were just detailing there.
Right.
And how do we free these people from that now? Because, I mean, that's one of the things that gets me with your book, is that this type of mindset has been around for as long as human beings have been around, I believe, and is not going to disappear overnight, if it ever does. So how do we coexist with this kind of mindset of authoritarian figures?
Eisenhower got this. Eisenhower, though he was criticized for being intellectually shallow, understood this, and he actually referred constantly to a book That's very similar to Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom, although I think Escape from Freedom is more accurate on the authoritarian personality, on the True Believer by Eric Hoffer. And Hoffer says in his book that faith in a holy cause is really a substitute for a lost faith in ourselves. And Fromm actually pioneered the concept of the self, which is the idea of, you know, the fully realized individual, what he called individual potentiality, the ability of individuals to develop fully in an open society. And what Dobson and his allies aim to do is to cut off children's development at a certain stage. You know, Eric Erickson, the psychologist, identifies 8 stages of development, and he says that authoritarians are cut off in the adolescent phase. It's why they seem to act like adolescent frat boys so often. Whether it's Bill O'Reilly, and his falafel-infused sexual harassment sprees, or George W. Bush, who went basically from an adolescent to a true believer in Jesus. And was only able to resurrect or ignite his political career through that, but maintain these adolescent qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Or Sarah Palin, who consistently uses adolescent words like bogus in her speeches, and awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really telling and revealing. So what do we do about it? I think this movement that I identify in my book, which you can, I guess, call the Christian right or the radical right, it will always be with us. The story of America is the story of competing traditions, and they represent one tradition.
But they're in
authoritarianism, and they'll always be here, but they have to be opposed and challenged politically, and we have to reject false visions of post-partisanship and post-racialism and actually engage them with the same energy that they bring into the streets with their teabag rallies. We have to meet them with the same energy and never underestimate their intentions or their influence. And I think that's something that happened in 2008, that we're seeing the consequences of it with Obama attempting to pass his health care reforms, that this movement is able to at least obstruct it, if not cause a lot of division and destruction.
Mm-hmm. And their influence is so much greater than their numbers. And regarding, that medical reform, they're terribly threatened by it. And can you say a little bit about that, what you think is behind it? By healthcare
in general.
There's so
much behind it. I mean, I just picked up at a flea market a booklet that George Wallace put out, the segregationist governor of Alabama, when he was running for president against the Civil Rights Bill. And the language was exactly the same in this pamphlet as it is in the literature and propaganda of the opponents of Obama's health care reform plan. It's that the government is planning a takeover through this policy, and that they're using it as a Trojan horse for socialism. And this movement grew out of the opposition to civil rights, so that really has a lot to do with it, the fear that the government will start to divert taxpayer money to minorities and those who are social deviants. But it goes further than that.
Well, one of the things that you say in your book is that the authoritarian style needs to have people that are in crisis, or that people in crisis are more vulnerable to an authoritarian voice telling them what to do. And if what doesn't create crisis to not have health care, personal crisis, it seems to be a way of keeping people in crisis.
They can be exploited.
That would be the second point I'd make. And if you, it's why I start my book on Christian Reconstructionism, or the idea of that under the undercurrent in this movement of theocracy, the idea that they want to replace secular government and all its functions with the church, and in order to do this, they have to undermine the secular government and show that the church can provide better care for people, whether it's through crisis pregnancy centers or providing health care. So when the government can step in and start making a noticeable difference in people's lives and implementing a progressive agenda, that's a huge threat to, first of all, the Christian Reconstructionist agenda, and to the racket that that evangelical churches were able to run under George W. Bush's faith-based community initiative, which was influenced by Christian Reconstructionism. Its intellectual godfather, Marvin Olasky, would frequently footnote R.J. Rush Dooney, who pioneered this Christian Reconstructionist vision of theocracy. So this is a major threat to their vision for societies. So is anything that's run by the federal government that will make a difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Max, this is Teresa.
They're running a crisis industry.
Mm-hmm.
This is Teresa again, and I'm very interested in what makes parents vulnerable to this authoritarian way of being. I have three daughters, all of whom right now are teenagers, and I've been able to observe not only my own kids, but also the other parents going through this phase. And what I've found is that parents are really floundering, that parents are kind of end up feeling like, oh, yes, I need to love my child. I need to indulge them. I need to encourage them. And they end up in a place where they, I don't know if they actually recognize it, but, you know, where the kids are have high expectations. They feel entitled. The parents are there to cook, to clean, to pay. and that the kids are there to have their freedom and to fulfill their dreams. There's not a lot of gratitude. Kids are wasteful. Kids are, frankly, kind of bratty. And I see with teenagers sometimes, one of my daughter's friends, her mother ended up having her kidnapped and taken to the mountains of Utah, where she was camping, you know, in the 10 to 20 below weather under a tarp for 3 months. And I look at that parent and I see where she, as much as I abhor that, you know, where she was driven to it, where she really didn't know what else to do. And I look at the smaller kids, and I have some of the friends who do the dare to discipline, but I have 9 out of 10 who are the other direction. And I have to say, the dare to discipline kids are nice. They're really, they're polite, they're gracious, they're happy when you do things for them. And so I guess what I'm wondering is whether, because of the media and because we live in a world where we have infinite access to the products of other people's labor that we're doing nothing to produce, that it has skewed our kids and that media has trained them into their entitlement to that. So how do we find a middle ground so that there's a reciprocity? It's not authoritarian, but it's also not the kids running over the parents, because I see kids, and my rule of thumb has been that the nicer the parents are, the more likely that the kids will be brats.
Hmm.
Well, if I knew the answer to that question, I'd be making a lot more money than I am now. That's just the key question, I think, for every parent, because no one has the answer. And I don't have any children of my own, but I was raised according to the principles of Dr. Benjamin Spock,
mm-hmm.
According to a lot of liberal ideas, but mainly I was a latchkey kid, and I was sort of raising myself, and my parents wanted to compensate for that by doing whatever I wanted, and so there were, you know, problems, but I mean, I've grown into a productive, creative person. So I think they feel somewhat vindicated. But when I was 10, I had an evangelical au pair who spent most of the time with me, and she would spend nights trying to convert me to Christianity, which was fascinating for me, because I'd get to learn about this sort of obscurantist theology and this culture she believed in, where she refused to read any book other than the Bible, even though she was a smart, capable woman. She would go out and organize anti-abortion rallies behind my mother's back while my mother was working for People for the American Way, fighting book banning campaigns in North Carolina. And she left for my parents' dare to discipline as a gift, if you could call it that, for them after working with me for a year. And maybe there is a middle ground, but when I saw during the Super Bowl in 2006, Focus on the Family ads showing children acting bratty in the supermarket and instructing parents to check out Focus on the Family's website for some techniques that can control your child. I was disturbed because when you look on Focus on the Family's website, they are advising you to deliberately spank your child and use other techniques of physical suppression. And Dobson advises you if your boy, your toddler, is having a gender identity disorder. In other words, he likes to play with My Little Pony and girls' toys.
Mm-hmm.
Take him into the shower as a father and show him your penis, because your penis is bigger than his, and this will handle that problem, according to Dobson. I think a lot of this advice is bizarre and possibly damaging. A recent study came out in September from the University of New Hampshire. The sample group was very small, so I think it needs to be conducted again. Showed that children who are spanked consistently until the age of 7 have lower IQs than children who are not, up to 5 to 10 points lower, which is actually significant. So I think that liberal parents who are treating their children with smother love are going to face other consequences. They're at least raising children who are fully developed and creative and have capacity for independent thought. Just one more thing that I would say about this is I have deep sympathy for parents of for evangelical parents, but for all parents, when I turn on MTV in the afternoon at the time when children are, you know, coming home from school, and I'm seeing just this licentiousness and overt, titillating, lewd sexuality that kids shouldn't be seeing, and also the idea that young girls, adolescent girls who are going through a rapid phase of development are spending most of their time online, and they're seeing images that denigrate women online, and their mothers have no way of knowing what they're seeing, so they have no way of having a conversation with them about those images and discussing with them how to internalize them. So there is a problem, and it's spread by corporations, and the Christian right will not discuss this problem of the corporate takeover of children's minds. In fact, they're funded largely by corporations, and the Republican Party isn't taking this on either. Instead, they're proposing filters for computers, and they're making a fortune off it. I think there needs to be a discussion about how corporate culture has made life impossible for parents.
Well, on some of my recent shows, I have a solution that is what I've come to, which is a home economy, is a way of creating your own system of kids earning things and tracking them and having, I mean, really it is bribes and threats, but it's something that works where things like technology and cell phones and computer time and TV time are limited, but also they earn the things that they buy, so that there is a system of reciprocity, and it's not just, this is what I want and it's your job to give it to me.
Well, I'm convinced that my parents tried that with me as well. I'm convinced that the more time parents spend with their children, the better off the children are, the more the parents are forthright with their children about you know, conflicts and issues of their own, of their development, the better off the children are going to be. But that's impossible for so many parents because people are working more and more, 50 hours a day, and with, you know, that should be part of the discussion on healthcare reform, that if people will be allowed to have a public option, they won't have to stay in these back-breaking jobs and just in order to maintain their healthcare plan, and they can spend more time raising their children and actually intervening in their children's lives. And the collapse of the middle class has so much to do with this, and people like Dobson are incapable of discussing the root causes behind the collapse of the family.
They may be capable, they're simply unwilling.
They're unwilling, and they view it as a Marxist frame. What I just said to them would be considered socialist, because only the church is allowed in their worldview to handle these problems.
Well, I want to say, what's wrong with that? I mean, it's almost afraid of the label socialist.
And well, Yeah, exactly.
And they have their followers convinced that health care reform or public option, God forbid single payer, is not in their best interest when in fact it is. I've just been shocked by the control that they wield over their people and all the tea parties and the other...
Well, only 63%, well, 63%, 65% of the public favors the public option, but only 20% or less identify themselves as liberal, which shows you how language...
There's progressive.
Language and beliefs. And how
yes.
they use language to
ostracize.
Overwhelm liberals, ostracize them, and convey the false notion that they represent the majority.
Mm-hmm.
They're brilliant. They're masters at public relations. We should take a lesson from them.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm dismayed by the way Obama's handled health care reform.
I know.
To come up with a compelling
label
for it. Under the Bush administration, we had the Clean Skies Initiative, which was really to allow power plants to pollute more and only have voluntary emission controls. We had Operation Iraqi Liberation, all these Orwellian phrases that Frank Luntz helped come up with. But we're not doing that on the progressive side. Instead, it's
they've hijacked language too, and they've framed the discussions.
As George Lakoff talks about with the framing, yeah, is that we're not paying much attention.
You did a show on that.
Yeah, they were going to call the alternative to the public option the trigger option. That sounds like a firing squad.
Oh, it does. Well, in your book, you've deconstructed it so well, the psychology. I'd never seen that before.
It had to be done, I thought, after meeting these people who would tell me what their psychology was without me even prompting. And I found Eric Fromm's book, Escape from Freedom, which, it isn't the answer. It's not.
I love that.
But it's a great book, and it helped me articulate what I was seeing in this movement. The premise of his book, which he wrote in 1941 after fleeing Nazi Germany and watching an authoritarian regime rise in a democratic society, is that the personal, the political is personal, that those who fear freedom, who can't handle freedom to exercise their individual will in an open society, will inevitably mm-hmm. form authoritarian structures and follow mm-hmm. authoritarian leaders. And the threat for that is just as great in the United States as it was in Germany because of the pressures that democracy and an open society places on people. I mean, we were just talking about some of the pressures that our society puts on parents and which leads them into the empire of Dobson. So I think he was prophetic.
So you saw that in the Republicans, the Christian rights that you were introduced to, that somehow you managed to get to know quite well. You're probably a big thorn on their side, no doubt.
Well, I found that, sort of the thesis of my book, that behind the politics of resentment and the histrionics is a culture of personal crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see it when Sarah Palin talks to Oprah Winfrey on Monday.
Oh.
She'll be talking unwittingly about the culture of personal crisis that she represents as a right-wing woman who's anti-abortion. She'll be talking about her decision to give birth to a child with Down syndrome in the context of her anti-abortion politics as a reflection of her values. She'll be talking about her daughter, Bristol, who was impregnated at 17 out of wedlock,
mm-hmm.
In the context of her belief in abstinence-only education. See, we see that as hypocrisy, and in a lot of ways it is hypocrisy, but for her, it's a way of conveying and projecting her identification with this widespread culture in the Christian right. It's why so many people see her as someone who's even greater than a political leader, someone who's like what Fromm would have called a magic helper, who's essentially a glamorized version of themselves.
But the culture of crisis isn't only happening to those Christian rights that it seems to me that the Mormons are doing a burgeoning business in wayward children these days. That seems like it's become the Utah industry to turn around these kids. So where does that come from? Why are we in this crisis of kids who basically have everything, who are turning around and throwing it away?
Well, because Eric Fromm talks about this in The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, the rise of the cybernetic man who becomes obsessed with things and gadgetry and having, he's writing this in the 60s, but it presaged the rise of video game culture, where children mm-hmm. can just escape into a false world, and parents often sit their kids in front of video games so they can avoid dealing with them, just mesmerize their children with images that drug their brains. And there are so many other entrapments for teenagers.
I was reading that
they eventually come to reject it and swing completely the other way because they realize the emptiness. They realize the emptiness of this cybernetic lifestyle, and they seek something more. And the Mormons are there. They're probably more effective at evangelizing than the evangelicals are. They're there to provide them with an easy context, and they'll sell them on the idea that this is a truly meaningful lifestyle, the Mormon lifestyle, which is actually more radical in so many ways than the evangelical lifestyle, because they are a genuine counterculture.
I used to live in Colorado in the western area, and I know.
I was reading that the average teenager now spends 3.5 hours a day alone, which is more than they spend with friends or with family, and that their friendships are much more superficial and change more readily, that they friend surf, you know, the same way that they channel surf, and that there's been a rise in malaise, in stomach aches, headaches, and at this extreme of it, suicide, which used to be the lowest for people who were between like 10 and 25, and now that's the highest group, that it's off the charts. So that isolation, I think, takes its toll. And I mean, you should know by my comments about the Bible being a hate document that, you know, I'm not going at this from a religious perspective, but I think the Mormons are onto something in terms of the community. That there is a real community, and there's an expectation that kids will be a part of it. We let our kids off the hook for that. You know, oh, you don't want to go and visit the relatives. You know, that's okay. You can take your iPod.
It's true. They have obligations for children. Obviously, we're not talking about the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints who have sex with children. But the mainstream Mormons do have more tight-knit communities than most communities in mainstream American culture. And throughout this conversation, we've been talking about middle-class society, almost suburban society, where since the 90s, children have consumed over 7 hours of media a day. Mm-hmm. But we haven't talked about what's happening in the inner city and what's happening in immigrant communities, where the situation is much worse. The Christian right has sought to make inroads because the government has been so inept and has been the cause of so many of these problems. And what we're seeing is middle-class society assuming and almost aping a lot of the problems we've been seeing in the inner city since the inner city came into being. And that really kind of presage some sort of a cultural collapse. And I really didn't address this in my book. I mean, we're kind of getting off track, but if I were to write a book about it, I would pinpoint the rise of corporations intervening in children's lives in the place of the parents.
That can be your next book. You won't leave anything unturned.
It is the next question, though, is What do you see beyond where we're at right now as far as the interplay between fundamentals, Christian in the Republican Party and the country in a whole? You said earlier that coming up with good buzzwords for programs that we're trying to promote would be a good thing to do, but where do you see that we can go?
Well, the Republican Party, because it's been taken over by this movement we've been discussing for the whole show, is not what I would call the GOP anymore, the grand old party. I would call it the ZOP, Zombie Occupied Party. It is without ideas, without an agenda. It just can only lurch towards Obama and toning brains, and it's eating itself alive. Look at what it's done in New York's 23rd district, where a popular Republican, moderate, was running for Congress, and the ZOP ran a no-name, third-party, far-right Tea Party activist in the race, forcing the Republican out, who was certain to have won, and allowing a Democrat to win in that district for the first time in 100 years. And now we see that one of the last moderates of the Republican Party in the Senate, Olympia Snowe from Maine, will be defeated if the Republican Party or the ZOP runs a zombie against her in the primary. And the Family Research Council, which is the lobbying arm for Focus on the Family, Dobson's group, has said that it would be open to putting up money for a primary challenger in Maine. Mm. So they're eating up all of the moderate candidates, eating their brains, and throwing them away and losing to Democrats just to prove how ideologically pure they are. And that's not a good sign for this party. I start the book describing how Eisenhower tried to protect the Big Tent Party, the Big Tent Republican Party, and its philosophy of holding power on a national level by playing to a diverse constituency and through good governance, and how that party... You know, and the book ends with the party turning into the one-ring circus of Sarah Palin, that has ideological purges and is destroying itself because it's populated by people who have a tendency to destroy their own selves.
As well as everyone else.
Ultimately, if they gain power, that's what would happen.
They're basically taking what they can and destroying it. They're not life-affirming.
But I think we shouldn't confuse those who are using this ideology, who are at the top, with the people who are following it.
I agree.
The key example always in my life is are my parents, who are pro-life. They are staunch Catholics, Republicans, voted for Bush, would have liked to have voted for him again. The abortion issue kind of colors everything, but underneath there is a sense of wanting to sacrifice, a feeling that they should be sacrificing for the good of others, and that we are so fortunate in this country to have so much that we really have to help other people. And when they look at the Iraq War or Afghanistan, they sincerely see it as a way of helping. The abortion issue is something that's very emotional to them. So I think that people are being manipulated really through their most noble impulses, that they are willing to go to war to help other people. And I don't find Democrats are. You know, I mean, we really don't have any sense of self-sacrifice.
I reject that completely.
Do you?
I mean, if you look at the difference in, you know, the army between the enlisted men and the officers, the enlisted men and women are mostly Democrats, and the officers are the hardcore Republicans. The military is not a monolithic institution, and it's the Democratic Party, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, that really believes in service. Look at the conspiracy theories of the right. Obama had attempted to introduce a civilian relief corps to help during national disasters, and so the right turns around and says this is the rise of socialism, this army will grow into something bigger than the military and will become Obama's Praetorian Guard like the SS. Look at their attacks on ACORN, a community organizing group. Look at their attacks. Look at the chicken hawk phenomenon in the neoconservative movement of sending kids off to die, for wars of choice that were designed by these soft-handed, pencil-necked geeks in the Pentagon who'd never even been in a fist fight. I think the right is a contingent that rejects the concept of public service, wants to privatize everything, and do all the hard work on the backs of the poor, who are largely Democrats. My book is really about a movement that wants to use to winnow out the federal government and boil everything down to the church, which is just an implicit attack on public service and on the idea of community. Mm-hmm. Community can't exist without some kind of central core to it. But mm-hmm. for them, the center of that has to be an exclusive group they refer to colloquially as the family. I'm not talking about the family that Jeff Charlotte identifies in his book. And they say we focus on the family, or a Republican politician is a friend of the family, or they're pro-family. They never say our families or your family. They say the family, because it's an exclusive contingent that has to adhere to a strict doctrine. And anyone who falls outside that doctrine, outside that sphere, is a social deviant, and they suffer the harshest wrath that this movement can conjure.
It's a good point, Max, and I agree with you. I think that really on both sides, that the rank and file are being manipulated, and it's really the best of our impulses and humanity that's being turned around to be used for the wealth of some.
Well, I think the a lot of the adherents of the movement of the Christian right are well-meaning people who are being manipulated, for sure, especially by people like Pastor Hagee, who preach prosperity gospel, or the idea that, if you give them your money, if you plant a seed with them, what they call a seed, that's a really an investment, and that seed will multiply, and that you'll get that money back tenfold, when in fact they're just using it to buy golden toilet seats in a fleet of private airplanes, and half of these guys have been subpoenaed by Charles Grassley, the senator from Iowa, because they're raping the pocketbooks of their followers. But when you meet those people who follow prosperity gospel churches, and studies have shown this, they genuinely believe that they are empowering themselves through the prosperity gospel to make more money and to lift themselves out of these situations.
They do.
Barbara Ehrenreich, in her new book, Bright Sided, kind of presents a top-down analysis.
Yeah, she's great.
Of the prosperity gospel, especially through Joel Osteen, mm-hmm. who's a complete fraudmeister from Houston, who operates out of the Houston Rockets former arena for a mostly minority flock. But my book, I think, is a bottom-up analysis.
Yeah.
And it presents the psychology of the followers of the movement. And many of the leaders are like the followers as well, and are not exploiters like Dobson. Yeah. Johnson is a true believer.
Max, we're going to have to end it here. And thank you so much. You were originally just going to be with us until 4:30, and I want to thank you for staying with us as long as you have. I hope you're not missing an appointment. Certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we did have more time, but I really want you to come back again. Free Radio Santa Cruz. And if you're ever in the area, we could get a hall for you.
Oh, great. Well, I love Santa Cruz.
Oh, one,
I love
yeah.
the beach there, and I've gone mushroom picking in the woods up there.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the more favorite pastimes around here for some. Oh, well, thank you so much. And that book just opened up my eyes to the real truth behind it. It answered questions for me.
Well, I mean,
about what was really going on.
If you haven't read the book yet, and you listen to
this,
if your listeners haven't read the book yet and they listen to this discussion that we've had, I mean, you see how provocative the book is, that we've gotten into a discussion about how to raise your kids. But it's really a book about a political movement That's what I wanted to do, was to provoke that kind of discussion.
You have. It needs
so
to get out.
It's a great book. Entertaining, funny,
shocking. And every
so
other
much information.
Impeccably researched and noted.
Yeah.
Very good job. Thank you so much.
And I can't wait to your next one on the corporations.
Well, we'll see what the next one is.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It was a real enjoyment. Pleasure.
Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye-bye.